This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
When I first started to provide primary care to children and youth with autism, one of our main goals was to refer patients to ABA therapy, and that was considered a success. And I learned over time, actually, that such referrals did not always work out. Families let me know that their children did not want to have ABA therapy, while others reported that their children loved their therapists because they were so flexible and seemed to understand their needs, which leads to a series of questions. What is appropriate therapy? What works? What's the evidence? Dr. Diane Cullinane received her MD from Baylor College of Medicine, completed internship and residency in pediatrics at Kaiser San Francisco, and pursued fellowship in child development at UCLA. She is board certified in neurodevelopmental disabilities. She is co-founder and executive director of Professional Child Development Associates in Pasadena, California for 23 years, and is author of the book Behavioral Challenges in Children with Autism and Other Special Needs, The Developmental Approach. Dr. Cullinane will now talk about spectrum of approaches to autism interventions.
Good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for inviting me to be part of this really nice conference. So I apologize for my voice. I have a pretty bad cold right now, but hopefully everyone can hear me despite that. So I have no conflicts to disclose. And I have a very big job today to talk about therapeutic approaches. And so I'm going to be going through a lot of things very quickly, but giving you references so that you can read more about any of the topics that might be of interest. So there are many words to describe what we do to help and care for autistic people. The topic of my speech here is therapeutic approaches, and that's a very broad term that could include any of these other words: treatment, support, services, interventions, focused intervention practices, comprehensive intervention models, and therapies. Each of these terms has a slightly different use and connotation, and there is a lot of overlap between them. So just so you know that we'll be using these different terms throughout this presentation. So as therapeutic approaches are used, it's really important to begin with awareness of the needs that we're trying to address. And what is the outcome that we're trying to achieve? And these ideas about what is our desired outcome have changed over time. And if you look at the American Academy of Pediatrics guidance that was published in 2020, you will see what I call the traditional goals: to minimize core deficits such as social communication and interaction, and restricted or repetitive behaviors and interests, eliminate, minimize, or prevent problem behaviors, and maximize functional independence. More recently, there's been a shift to a greater emphasis on respecting the needs of the individual, with more attention to interventions that foster sensitivity to and understanding of individual preferences, acceptance and accommodations for unique behaviors and special interests, and a focus on the desire for social connection and the quality of relationships, especially parent-child relationships. And this is the reference to that American Academy of Pediatrics guidance from 2020. So what has caused this shift in the goals of intervention? There have been two main forces. The first is greater attention to reports from autistic adults about their experiences. Groups like ASAN, Autism Self-Advocacy Network, and the neurodiversity movement more broadly have demanded to be recognized, accepted, and heard. And secondly, an increasing appreciation for sensory and motor differences that are present from infancy and that have cascading effects on development. These are two references which give perspective of autistic adults As you know, there are many, many autobiographies and discussions on social media, which provide important insights. This article, the first article, provides a framework for research on the autistic experience and how it is similar or different from neurotypical. And the second article is just one of many personal stories that I found particularly enlightening. And in regards to cascading effects from sensory motor differences or susceptibilities and the changes in social interactions that lead to features recognized as autism, these are three excellent articles that will describe that in more depth if you're, again, interested in learning more. In regards to psychosocial behavioral therapeutic approaches, there are three main categories of intervention. That's the behavioral interventions, NDBI or naturalistic developmental behavioral interventions, and developmental or developmental relationship-based interventions, DRBI, a lot of acronyms. This is a reference to a short article that I wrote for the Carlatt Report of Psychiatry, or child psychiatry, which outlines these three briefly and the differences between them. But I will offer some more thoughts on that here. So first, in regards to behavioral approaches are based on ABA, or applied behavioral analysis. ABA is an approach to understanding and changing behavior based on the way environmental factors impact behavior. All ABA programs use what's called the ABC paradigm, meaning antecedent, or what are the environmental conditions before a behavior occurs, B for the behavior, and C for consequence, or what occurs in the environment to either reinforce or extinguish the behavior. Strategies used in ABA include things like prompting, modeling, reinforcement, shaping, chaining, etc., to teach a desired behavior. Ivar Lovaas wrote the first major paper in 1987 about using behavioral approaches to teach autistic children. He used a form of ABA called DTT, discrete trial training. He believed that every skill needed to be broken down into discrete steps, and each step was taught in a series of highly repetitive drills. It was very intensive, up to 40 hours per week of one-to-one intervention. It's been almost 40 years since this pioneering work, and there have been many advances in ABA methodology, but still using the same ABA theoretical framework. EIBI, or Early Intensive Behavioral Intervention, is a term for broad programs that use ABA, which may include DTT, but also more flexible forms of ABA. And here is a reference up to date regarding ABA and the methodologies. The second category is naturalistic developmental behavioral interventions, or NDBI. And this was presented as a new category in 2015. NDBI uses behavioral ABC paradigm, but also adds developmental concepts. For example, goals would include joint attention, imitation, and social engagement, which are developmental precursors for later skills. NDBI embed teaching episodes in play and daily routines. They involve training parents so that parents learn to use the strategies in daily activities. NDBI also use natural contingent reinforcers. For example, if a child responds correctly, excuse me, to a prompt about cars, they may be allowed to play with the car rather than being given a sticker, M&M, or something unrelated to the activity. There are many types of NDBI. You may recognize some of these names, including Early Start Denver Model, Pivotal Response Training, Jasper, Project Impact, enhanced milieu teaching. In your slides, you may also have CERTS, but in here you see it's crossed out. And the reason is CERTS was developed by Dr. Barry Prezant, and I spoke to him just a few days ago, and he feels that CERTS is incorrectly categorized as an NDVI and should be considered a developmental relationship-based intervention. And here's a reference of a book that's published in 2020 that has, of course, a lot of information about NDVI. When a child has challenging behavior, interventions using a behavioral perspective are commonly used to target that specific behavior. Positive behavioral support is an approach widely used in the schools. Within the ABC framework, the A or antecedents are evaluated to see what in the environment may be contributing to the behavior, and then changing those factors to try and prevent the problem behavior. And the C, or the consequence in positive behavioral support, would be to teach replacement behaviors or new skills, and then reward compliance rather than using any form of punishment or negative consequence. I hope my voice lasts. I'm sorry about that. When behaviors are more intense, there may be a call for functional behavioral assessment. Functional behavioral analysis is a more specific and complex form of an assessment. From a behaviorist perspective, behavior has four specific functions: either seeking attention, escape from demands, access to tangibles, or sensory stimulation. An assessment tries to determine the functions of the particular targeted behavior and then creates a behavior plan to achieve the desired behavioral change. There are also a number of parent training programs which use the ABA approach. And this is a review article that talks about the different parent training programs using the ABA perspective. The next category of intervention is the developmental or developmental relationship-based intervention. The DRBI approach was first described in use with autistic children in 1997 through the writings of Stanley Greenspan and Serena Weider. The developmental framework has two major components. First, a focus on internal motivation as the impetus for learning and development, rather than environmental factors. And secondly, a focus on individual relationships and how social interactions are integral to development. DRBI strategies include encouraging spontaneous creative play and shared play experiences, following the child's lead, meaning sensitively joining in their intent, and then playfully challenging the child to advance along the developmental trajectory. Importantly, DRBI avoids directiveness and the use of behavioral teaching and strategies such as prompting specific behaviors. And this is an article that we published last year, just the end of last year, that describes the defining features of DRBI and how DRBI is distinguished from naturalistic developmental behavioral interventions. There are many types of DRBI. DIR floor time, or simply floor time, play project, which is derived from DIR, responsive teaching, JAML, which is now called BISC, PACT, positive developmental model, rhythmic relating, and now I've added CERTS to this list. Another novel DRBI is a preemptive intervention known as I-BASIS, VIPP. So a report in 2021 describes this intervention. Parents of infants an average of 12 months of age that showed early signs of autism The parents participated in 10 sessions of coaching. The goal was to increase parents' awareness of their infants' social communication and guide their responses to build social engagement and interaction. The infants were then followed to 3 years of age and found to have decreased in autism symptoms and autism diagnosis. This was quite a remarkable in that this brief intervention provided only to parents had a significant impact on child development. The developmental approach to behavioral challenges is quite different from a behavioral approach. Assessment is done to determine the child's social emotional capacities and their individual sensory motor profile. The developmental intervention for behavioral challenges is focused on providing support to help the child in the moment of their distress and dysregulated behavior, and then create a plan to improve any of the underlying developmental delays or constrictions. The approach is based on the strength of relationships. And this is a book that I wrote about the developmental approach to behavioral challenges. Another type of service is family support programs specifically for autism. So many children receive a diagnosis of autism and then must wait for months to get started in an intervention program. So there are programs popping up that try and fill this gap. Empower Autism is one example. It's a manualized program of 5 3-hour or 10 90-minute sessions for parents to address the emotional relational and information needs. Another program is called SAFE, which provides similarly 5 3-hour sessions over 4 months. And this program recognizes that families may include persons who may have the broader phenotype of autism, and there may be an increased incidence of mental health challenges. And there are other types of family support services and services specifically for siblings, which I know is one of the topics during this conference. And here are the references for those two programs that I just mentioned. An important question is, what is the optimal number of hours and length of intervention? In early research, it was recommended that ABA be provided 40 hours per week in one-to-one intervention. A survey in 2022 showed the average number of hours for children receiving ABA was 11 hours per week. So there have been many, many studies that have looked to see if intensity is related to outcomes. And most studies have not found a relationship. Although these studies are looking at groups of children, and so it still may be true that intensive services, more hours per week, are appropriate for specific children and always should be individualized. And here are three recent review articles that all report no association between intensity and outcomes. And later on, I'll also reference two other reviews, Franz and Chang, which also have not found any association between outcome and intensity. So this graphic illustrates a path from low quality studies, low quality reviews, leading to poor decisions for evidence-based practice and then to bad policy. This path shows the concerns of current evidence-based standards for autism interventions. There are a lot of studies about autism intervention. However, when those studies are rated in terms of quality and risk of bias, many have very low ratings. Why is that? Basically, because it's very hard to do large randomized control trials of autism interventions. Reviews gather these studies and then make a determination of scientific merit or strength of evidence for a particular type or category of intervention. The challenges for reviewers is that there are wide variations in the autistic children themselves, wide variations in the controls, and the outcome measures, and the intensity. There's also a lot of variation in how reviews are done. So the end result is that there is significant criticism of the standards used to determine what is merit, scientific merit. And then policy is often determined based on these reviews and can be slow to change with new information. These are two reviews from 2018 that brought attention to the high risk of bias and the low quality of evidence in early intervention research. And these are more recent articles that discuss the concerns about standards of evidence and present important ideas for improving quality of research and reviews going forward. For example, doing analyses to determine what are the active ingredients in interventions that have multiple components and looking at broader outcomes rather than specific or proximal outcomes. Now let's look at some of the most recent reviews of autism interventions, and I will briefly mention six reviews in chronological order. So the first one here is the Steinbrenner et al. Review that was comes from University of North Carolina, the National Clearinghouse on Autism Evidence and Practice. This is their third iteration and included studies up through 2017. So it names as evidence-based 28 focused interventions. And I'm just listing a few of them here, but it includes behavioral approaches like prompting, reinforcement, and discrete trial training. It also includes as evidence-based naturalistic interventions and parent-implemented interventions, which include both NDBI and DRBI types of approaches. And here's the reference. And then this review, Chang et al. From 2022, it actually included studies through June of 2020, and it's a meta-analysis of parent-implemented interventions. So it's a meta-analysis and looked at a lot of studies and included both NDBI and DRBI. Both are parent-implemented and showed moderately strong overall benefit. And this is the reference for that review. And then moving forward, this review, Trembath et al., looked at, is an umbrella review. So it's a review of reviews and looked at reviews through July of 2020, looking at nine categories of intervention and found positive therapeutic effects for behavioral, developmental, NDBI, as well as what they call technology-based and CBT, or cognitive behavioral therapy. And they do make the point that there is no evidence for a single best intervention. And there was the review, the reference. You'll have it in your handouts. And then one more here. This is now moving forward through December of 2020. Early intervention for very young children, less than 36 months, with a high likelihood of autism. And they do note there were all types of interventions showed positive effects, but that they mentioned that the quality of these studies had an impact on their ability to draw any firm conclusions regarding which treatments are most effective. And then the AIMS study, which was done initially in 2020 and then updated in 2023, and includes analysis of research through November 21. And found that, again, behavioral, NDBI, and developmental all had positive effects. So getting the sense that over and over again, we're getting the same information from these reviews. And the last review that I'll mention is Dennett's, which is a systematic review and meta-analysis through journals through 2023, parent-mediated play-based interventions, again, including DRBI and NDBI, and found positive effects on social communication and language skills and autistic characteristics. And again, like most of these, express some concerns regarding the quality of the studies. So we're really in kind of the infancy, I would call it, of autism research. Although there's a lot of studies, they're still at the beginning stages of having very well-designed randomized control trials of these different interventions. So we've been talking about psychosocial and behavioral approaches, but of course there are a wide variety of programs and services that may be needed and helpful for an autistic child or adult. These include medical care, special education services, therapies, and other specialty services. Many disciplinary specialties may be able to contribute their knowledge and skills to support a comprehensive plan. And I was thinking I might add safety to this list, as families may need to create plans to protect a child who tends to wander or who needs constant supervision for safety. And I also just wanted to recognize the role of mental health counselors. Many children experience bullying, rejection, trauma, abuse, leading to anxiety and depression. And counseling can support autistic individuals as well as family members to improve their quality of life. And then, as my talk is supposed to cover children and adults, we'll at least have one slide here about adults. Specialized supports and services are also needed for autistic adults. And there are some wonderful innovative programs for housing, employment, and social groups. In regards to physical help, there are medical concerns with increased incidence that occur in autism. These might include seizures, GI issues, allergies, and cardiovascular concerns. In mental health, autistic adults may be vulnerable to feelings of being overwhelmed by sensory experiences, have meltdowns, anxiety, and depression. Again, there are safety issues, as autistic adults may be vulnerable to manipulation or abuse, or may engage in dangerous behaviors to themselves or others. And then I also thought we could add financial planning, as this is another area where special knowledge and guidance is needed for families as they plan for the future. Every individual is unique, but it's important to recognize that services and supports may be needed and helpful throughout their lifespan. This is an article about cardiometabolic disease in autism, which I think is an under-recognized area of concern. Autistic children and adults are at an increased risk of obesity, an increased risk of diabetes, dyslipidemia, and heart disease. So just to draw a little attention to that. And here are two references that discuss the biological aspects of autism. Although we don't yet have many biological interventions, as more and more is learned about neurodevelopment, physiology, molecular pathways, it's hoped that this information will help to and complement our psychosocial and behavioral approaches. And I think these two articles are very interesting, and I especially look forward to hearing Dr. Marco's presentation this afternoon. So how do we provide best practice approaches at this time? First, families should be provided with informed consent. This means that families should be informed about the range of intervention approaches, as well as the most recent research showing that there is no one best intervention. We can no longer say that behavioral approaches are more evidence-based. Secondly, families need to know what is available in their area and what is possibly funded. This is very different from one area to another. In California, we passed a law which says that insurance will cover all evidence-based behavioral health treatment. We're looking forward to when this will go into effect in July of 2026, as it will help families have a true choice in the type of approach that is best for their child. Also note that there is a disconnect between research and community programs. Many of the types of intervention described in research are not generally available in the community. On the other hand, there are community programs that may not be described in research. So it's important to learn what may be available in your area. Finally, there should be continual monitoring of progress. Decisions are not final. Once the family in professional chooses a program to try, there needs to be continual monitoring of effectiveness and satisfaction and make appropriate adjustments as needed. This is my last slide. The first is an article about intervention recommendations based on the changing evidence base. And the second is just a book that I think is a good resource. It's an easy to read book with short chapters covering a wide range of topics, but it has extensive references for further reading. So thank you for your attention, and I'm happy my voice lasted, and I'm now available for questions.
Thank you so much for describing and categorizing the array of therapeutic approaches in such an understandable way. And I'm actually still processing what you had just mentioned and look forward to reading the references. And so I'm wondering, is it that some aspects of some therapies work for some people, and that it's really important to do the monitoring? I think that was your third point. And I'm wondering, are there things like early markers of success that you're on the right track in terms of a particular therapeutic approach? And then sort of taking a step back, is it that therapists are flexible and can use different approaches, or are therapists bound to one approach? In which case you have to find another therapist. I know these are confusing questions.
Yeah. Those are huge questions. And there are a lot of factors that go into it. A lot of it, unfortunately, just has to do what's available and what is there funding for. And hopefully the choices will become a little bit easier next year when this, in California at least, when the law goes into effect, then there'll be a broader array of funding. But, and again, it starts with the clinicians being aware of the options, being able to explain that to parents, giving parents some input into those choices. Then, everybody sort of makes their best informed guess, if I would say, of where can I get in, where can I start, what I think will be a good match, and then you try it and see. And for some, you asked what the markers of success are. I think it's kind of you just have to have close follow up, because usually parents will be able to give you pretty good feedback about how they observe their child's functioning. And it's definitely possible to, for example, do both behavioral and developmental approaches simultaneously, as long as, I would say, you divide up what your goals are. For example, there may be a social skills group that's very, very developmental, but you have a behavioral program at home, which is helping the child learn how to do their chores, set the table, put their book backpack away, and organize their some of those kind of daily activities. The problem I see that might happen is if you have both, say, a developmentalist and a behaviorist both working on the same activity, like, for example, feeding or whatever it might be, because then everybody's going to get very confused about what strategies should be used in that situation. You can do all of one, all of the other, or a combination, and any of those might work for any particular child.
I'm wondering, you point out that ABA doesn't have a great evidence base. I'm wondering whether randomized controlled trials are really the gold standard when you're talking about something as global as development. You're not talking about does a medication change some very specific item? And so, what do you think is the role of what autistic adults say about their childhood interventions and what was helpful and what was unhelpful for them? Because there's a lot of criticism of early intervention and ABA in particular in the autistic community. And it's a very heterogeneous group, of course.
Well, first, I didn't mean to imply that there isn't good evidence for behavioral approaches. The point that I was making in all of those reviews and findings is that all approaches have evidence of effectiveness. What we shouldn't say, though, is that there's more evidence for behavioral versus other approaches. That's what's changed. All three types or categories of approaches may work very well for particular children and particular families. I think you're right that a lot of adults who have had ABA have talked about their very negative experiences from it. They were felt to that they were being controlled, that what they wanted to do, what they were interested in, was taken away from them, and they were manipulated. And I think nowadays there's some differences in how ABA is performed, and it's more flexible and more respectful. It just, again, it gets down to be very individual, and individual in terms of not just the child, but also the interventionist. Because some families say, my interventionist is wonderful. My child loves them. They love when they come over. They're learning so much and obviously are having a great experience. But I think if, as a parent, if you see that your child is unhappy, is distressed and is stressed by whatever intervention is being done, then as a parent, you should feel empowered to say, this isn't working. I need something different.
So the relationship, it sounds like the relationship is really key between the therapist and the child.
Absolutely, absolutely, yes. They always need to have a relationship of trust and warmth and care. And I know that the behaviorists and developmentalists would all agree on that.
And I know there's so many questions, and I'm hoping that you might be able to answer some of them in the backstage. But maybe I'll end with one other question, which is whether DRBI approaches are being promoted at the school districts.
The blunt answer to that is no. I feel that, especially in California, the policies in the Department of Education are just so slow to respond to new research. And you could say 10, 20 years ago, there wasn't as much information about developmental approaches, and so there are a lot of interventions and policies, I should say, have been formed around a very much a behavioral perspective. And I would really hope that that might be updated in the near future. If anyone has any ideas how to tackle that, please let me know.
So more collaboration amongst all of us. So, well, thank you so very much. And I think all of us will be thinking about what you've said, and we'll be looking up the resources, etc. So thank you for opening our minds.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.